It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Live from the Green Space, our ground floor theater here at the WNYC location at 160 Varick Street in Lower Manhattan. We do the show from here about once a month. So if you're not here today, listen for our next time if you want to come. Usually it's the, let's see, am I getting this right? I think it's the second Wednesday of every month is our current pattern. So look it up and you can buy tickets for whatever that day is. In November and December and January even if you want to. And when we're in the green space, we also stream live video because there are cameras installed here so you can see me and my guests. So if you want to watch the show as well as listen today, you can go to WNYC.org and check out that video stream. With us now, I'm very happy to have David Miliband here in the green space. He has gone from being Britain's foreign secretary and before that environment secretary to president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, where he oversees the agency's humanitarian relief operations in more than 40 war-affected countries and its refugee settlement and assistance programs in 28 United States cities. He published a book last year called Rescue, Refugees, and the Political Crisis of Our Time. I know he's just back from Yemen, which has one of the most intense refugee crises right now. And he's here today as a point of view guest in our fall election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. We'll actually get a more conservative view afterwards from the former Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. The issue and the news hook in this case, Trump's recent cut in the number of refugees to be allowed into the U.S. next year to just 30,000. That would be the lowest since the year 1980. This year it's 45,000. In President Obama's last year in office, it was 110,000. David Miliband is very outspoken on this. In April, he wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post called On Refugees, the Trump Administration is Competent and Malevolent. But what does he really think? Audience, please welcome David Miliband to the green space. Thank you.
Hello, Brian. Nice to be with you in person. I know that you really exist. You're not just a disembodied voice.
And now I know that you're not just your very impressive disembodied voice. What's a refugee? How do you know a refugee from a regular immigrant or an asylum seeker?
A refugee is someone for whom it's not safe to go home. It's the baker bombed out of his bakery in Damascus. It's the girl driven out of northeast Nigeria by the Boko Haram terrorist group. An immigrant is someone who leaves their country in search of a better life. A refugee is someone who's forced to flee their country to save their life.
Asylum seeker?
An asylum seeker is someone who has left their country but claims refugee status not in the first country they land in, but in a third country. So, for example, if a Syrian goes to Jordan, the vast bulk of refugees will register with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees in Jordan. But some of them will go on and they might try and claim asylum in Europe, in Germany. The American example would be someone who is fleeing gang violence in El Salvador or Guatemala. They don't claim asylum next door. They make it to the United States and they claim asylum here.
And when it comes to refugees, when I first read your Washington Post article, I thought the headline said Trump on this is incompetent and malevolent, but it's really competent and malevolent. Why those two adjectives?
The idea came from the general commentary at the time, which was accusing the administration of being incompetent as well as malevolent. And I wanted to make the point that this is for people often on the right were bemoaning what they perceived to be the incompetence of the administration, even if they agreed with some of the policy goals. I was saying that in this area, the administration has, sadly, in my view, and in the view, I think, of many people, not just in the US, but around the world, started to turn down the light, the bright, shining light that America offered for the humanitarian help it offered around the world. The administration has tried to cut the amount of overseas assistance, the foreign aid that goes and that we see and that we partner with the US around the world in countries like Yemen that are war-torn. But it's also snuffing out this very distinctive bipartisan American program. which has had, I mean, the most refugees that ever came to the US were under the Reagan administration in the beginning of the 1980s. And it was a bipartisan program that is well run, that achieves good results because refugees have higher levels of employment than the native-born population. They actually pay more in taxes than they take out in welfare benefits. There's been no fatal terrorist attacks by any refugees. That's a false sort of myth that's put around. And so this successful bipartisan program is being reduced and is in danger of being snuffed out. You made the point, Brian, that the cap that the administration had for the fiscal year 18, which ended on September the 30th, was 45,000. But it wasn't 45,000 refugees who were allowed in. Only 22,000 were allowed in.
Right. 45,000 was the legal cap, and they didn't even let in half that many.
Exactly. And so the great fear now is that with the legal cap reduced to 30,000, the historic low, that if there's a continued underperformance, if you like, below the cap, then America will be down at the absolutely nugatory levels. And some of the smallest European countries, I think Ireland takes 5,000 refugees, Canada famously last year took 30,000 refugees. And so no one pretends that refugee resettlement, which is the organized transfer of the most vulnerable refugees, victims of torture, people who've lost family members. No one pretends that the transfer of those most vulnerable people to safe countries is the answer to the refugee problem, because there are 25 million refugees around the world. But it's a very important part of an effective and comprehensive response. Of course, most refugees are in countries close to those at war. I mean, Turkey's got 3.5 million Syrians. Jordan has got 650,000 Syrians. Bangladesh has just received 700,000 Rohingya Muslims in the last year. I mean, just in parentheses, those countries don't know whether to laugh or cry when they hear Americans saying, oh, it's a crisis to have 10 or 20,000 people arrive, because these are countries that have got hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people arriving. But in those countries, the vast bulk of humanitarian aid is needed to support people, hopefully eventually to go home, although relatively few do. But it's vital that for the most vulnerable, they're able to come to some countries like the US. And the fact that the US should be retreating is a source of enormous sadness, not to say anger, around the world.
Can you talk a little more about the history that you referenced when you mentioned Reagan? You know, and I think about this number, 30,000 being described as the lowest since 1980. And people might think, oh, yeah, well, since Reagan, you know
the 80s. Reagan was in the 200,000 plus.
Right. So 1980 was really the last year of the Carter administration. And if that was the low, then Reagan must have increased the number of refugees.
Yeah, well, what you had was the passage in 1980 of the 1980 Refugee Act. And that brought into American law for the first time the 1951 Refugee Convention, which said that a refugee was someone who had a well-founded fear of persecution. And that was put into American English and made legal. And then in the early 1980s, 81, 82, you had over 200,000 refugees, many of them from Southeast Asia, from Vietnam, obviously, because the refugee story is partly about need, it's partly about national responsibility. I mean, it's not an accident that the largest number of refugees who've ever come to the U.S. are Vietnamese. I mean, it speaks to the trauma that America and Vietnam went through in the 60s and 70s. And the other point I think is interesting is that it's an important part of foreign policy. To have a country that lives by its responsibilities and frankly holds a candle against the dictatorships and oppressive regimes around the world that do persecute people and drive them out. And it's a terrible irony at the moment that while the administration is saying that it wants to stand up for the people of Iran who want to protest against the perfidy of their own government, they won't let Iranians who are protesting and are persecuted as a result come here. And that is an important thing to recognize in all the talk that we have about conflict. Refugee status is also for those who have a fear of persecution. Just to make it more relevant maybe to my organization, remember the International Rescue Committee is a great New York organization founded by Albert Einstein, who was a refugee in the 1930s and wanted to do something to help those who were trapped in Nazi-occupied Europe. And he created the International Rescue Committee. And it says something about New York. It wasn't an accident that he was in New York. He was in New York because it was an open city in an open country.
And your parents were refugees, weren't they?
Yeah, my parents were refugees. I mean, I look like and probably sound like the product of the longest period of peace and prosperity that Europe has ever known. And I am that product. I was born in the mid 1960s, 1965. I mean, I'm fighting the aging process, but losing. But I was brought up in a safe and secure household in a safe and secure country. But my dad was a 16-year-old who fled Belgium in 1940. My mum fled Poland in 1946 as a 12-year-old. And they were both refugees and given refugee status.
Listeners, my guest is David Miliband. He's president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, which works on behalf of refugees around the world with direct relief as well as advocacy, as you're hearing. We can take some phone calls for him. I wonder if anybody is out there on different sides of this issue. Do you support the cut that the Trump administration is announcing for next year to 30,000 refugees max compared, say, to 110,000 that the Obama administration authorized in its last year? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And here's a clip of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in his announcement of the lower refugee cap last month.
The improved refugee policy of this administration serves the national interest of the United States and expands our ability to help those in need all around the world. We will continue to assist the world's most vulnerable while never losing sight of our first duty, serving the American people. We are and continue to be the most generous nation in the world.
A laugh line in the green space for Mike Pompeo. Are we the most generous nation in the world by some measures that pertain to refugees? What was Secretary of State Pompeo referring to there, as far as you can tell?
Well, it's quite hard to find the figures to back that up. Obviously, if you look at government overseas aid, the US spends about 0.17% of national income on overseas aid. A country like the UK actually spends 0.7%. We're a smaller economy, but as in percentage terms. The US spends about $8 billion a year on international humanitarian aid. That makes it a large donor, but there are other countries that are of a similar order of magnitude. And if you look at total development spending, European countries now together, if you count them together, spend more. On the refugee resettlement front, we've been through the figures. One thing I do want to say, though, is that people often say to me, as an organization that's working in war zones for people affected by war, but is also resettling refugees in the US, what's it like to be leading that organization at a time of backlash? And what I always say to them is, look, whatever the political rhetoric, when we resettle refugees in Dallas or in Houston or in New York or in Boise, Idaho, there is an American generosity that comes through very, very strongly. The neighbors who live next to the refugees who settle, the first thing they do is they come and introduce themselves. They want to make them welcome. They want to teach their kids English. They want to help them get into networks. They want to explain how the local health system works. And so I don't think this is about whether or not Americans are more or less generous. It's whether or not they've got the capacity and the political will to rise to the global challenges that exist today. Because we are not talking about a cut in the number of refugees at a time when there are fewer and fewer refugees. It's really important to say that this assault on your refugee resettlement program is happening at a time when there are record numbers of refugees and displaced people around the world. And it's that contrast that is especially sad. I approach this with sadness rather than in anger. I moved to the US 5 years ago to lead the IRC. And one of the things I had the good fortune to oversee is a bipartisan, successful program. And so it's with sadness rather than anger that one listens to the attempt to justify a 75% reduction in the maximum number of refugees allowed as a generous act. And it's also important to remember that it's not like the funds from refugees are being transferred to overseas aid, because the administration is trying to cut the overseas aid budget as well. And the truth is, I love this quote from John Kennedy in 1962 on American Independence Day. He made this speech saying that Alexander Hamilton told his generation of Americans to think continentally, in other words, to think about the country as a whole. And JFK said, my generation, his generation of Americans, need to think intercontinentally, in other words, to think globally. Now, that's more true 50 or 60 years later, because the world is that much more connected. Security problems or economic problems or health problems that start in Syria or Yemen or Afghanistan don't stay in Syria or Yemen or Afghanistan. They come around the world. And that's why I think there's a self-interested, if you like, an America First case for an overseas aid policy, not just a big-hearted case for an effective overseas aid policy and a refugee resettlement policy.
I love when we get global perspectives on things, because you didn't just call the 4th of July Independence Day. You called it American Independence Day.
Yes.
And one of the articles I was reading about you to prepare for this segment referred to this season as Northern Autumn.
Not by me. I wouldn't have called it Northern Autumn. I would have called it Autumn.
We have a couple of calls of pushback coming in. Let's take them. Anthony in Port Chester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony. All right, I might have pressed the wrong button. Control room line one, Anthony in Port Chester. Anthony,
yeah.
Hi there. We have you now.
Hi, Brian. You know, I was listening to what this gentleman said, but you know what? You have a country of black people in America who those same neighbors that he was talking about in Dallas, Boise, would never even think to welcome and help. You know, you have refugees come from Iran, Iraq, anywhere, and American people will help them. They'll get a loan at a bank quicker, or where a black person, you know, in the same financial situation, couldn't get that loan. Even my parents, I grew up in Westchester County, and my parents couldn't get a loan for their house in 1966 in Westchester County. We had to go to a bank in Long Island.
So, Anthony, all these things being true, does that make you think that the United States should not take in refugees in crisis around the world? Do you think the plight of black people in America will be any better if we don't?
No, I don't think that we shouldn't take refugees in. I still see the need. I still see what's going on in America, especially in Yemen. You know, so I don't. I just wish it was more. I just wish they were more fairer to black people in America. You know, I just wish that it was a lot better for us. You know, I'm 63 years old. You know, and yeah, my children are doing better than I did at my age. You know, they're doing much better. It's just that it just doesn't seem fair that when you see these people come in and they open a restaurant or they open a gas station or a grocery store in our neighborhood, you know, and we couldn't get that same loan to do that.
I hear you.
You know, but no, I'm not going to ever say that I want to be against, you know, people trying to get in. You know, I'm appalled at what this government is doing, and I'm totally against anything President Trump's doing. But I just wish that gentleman had a better perspective of what black people go through in this country, because we're refugees in our own country.
I hear you. Anthony, thank you so much. Let's go on to Linda on line two in Brooklyn. Hi, Linda. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I am so in favor of immigration. I believe it helps our country in so many ways. But I live in a community that has a large Russian population. And when I interact with some of these people, they are so against immigration. They just got here. And it boggles my mind when your guest said that he was saddened. I think that's the best word I've heard, because I'm very sad that people don't see the plight of others and want them to have the same advantage or the ability to get somewhere that they had. Can that be explained in any way?
Linda, thank you. David Miliband.
Well, thank you, Linda. I agree that it's sad, obviously. I haven't got an explanation, and I don't want to sort of stereotype the Russian population in respect of this. But I think that there's a wider point, isn't there, which both Anthony and Linda are pointing to, which is that either you believe that you succeed at the expense of other people who are in your country, or you believe you succeed with other people in your country. And that's an important element of the debate about the American story, really. And I think it's not about whether or not you believe in open borders. No one says that anyone should be able to come here. But I think that managed migration, and with refugees as part of that, is an essential part of this country's story. And if this country doesn't stand up for that idea, then very few others will.
And I thought Linda was going to be pushing back herself on taking refugees.
I mean, let me take on with it. There's one argument that's often put, which might be in people's minds. Well, what about the security aspects? Because people often say, well, hang on, is it safe to have people coming?
In fact, let me play one more clip of Secretary of State Pompeo in announcing this refugee cut, where I think he addresses it.
Already this year, we have seen evidence that the system previously in place was defective. It allowed a foreign national to slip through, who was later discovered to be a member of ISIS, as well as other individuals with criminal backgrounds. The American people must have complete confidence that everyone granted resettlement in our country is thoroughly vetted. The security checks take time, but they're critical.
David Miliband.
Well, I've been advocating exactly that we should have effective security checks. No one argues about that. And here's the irony of what Secretary Pompeo says. He says he's improved the security. So what's he got to argue that we shouldn't now let the refugees in who meet the security tests? And I think it's very important not to hide behind this security argument. After 2001, the Bush administration suspended the program for a couple of months, checked the security system, improved it, and then restarted the program. Every year, it's completely legitimate for the US government to make sure that the security vetting system is up to scratch. But now we've got an administration that says, we're confident in our security vetting system, but we still won't let people in. And that is a contradiction, which is just unconscionable, really, because it takes away that fundamental excuse that was being used before, that somehow the security justified it. Remember, even Iraqis and Afghans who've worked for the US military and for US diplomats, who've stood side by side with US generals in war zones as their translators, even they are not being allowed in. So there are 100,000 Iraqis who have helped in some way or another the US diplomats or the US forces. They fear for their own lives because they might be targeted for helping the US. And now, in the last year, we've got evidence that only about 650 Iraqis have been allowed in, even though they've proven themselves of value to the US government.
Let me ask you about another aspect of this. I was reading the pro-Trump nationalist news site Breitbart, which does a lot of articles on this refugee cap, has done a lot of articles on the refugee cap, which explicitly or implicitly support the idea. And here are a couple of the angles. They write, refugee settlements to the U.S., citing Reuters, from countries with known Islamic terrorist problems has greatly dropped. For example, about 250 Somali refugees have been resettled. At this time during 2016, under Obama, about 8,300 Somali refugees had been allowed to resettle across the country. This represents a 97% decrease in refugee settlement from Somalia, which Breitbart frames as a country with a known Islamic terrorist problem. Another Breitbart article points out that the percentage of Muslims among the refugees being settled in the United States now has dropped from a majority to a minority, and now 70% of the refugees being settled in the U.S. are Christians. Well, do you know that to be true?
Yeah, let's just be clear about this. Three points. Number one, the reduction in the number of refugees has hit the Muslim numbers hard, about an 80% reduction. But what's happened to the number of Christians being allowed in? That's been reduced by about 60% as well. So this is hitting Christians as well as Muslims.
So fewer Christians as well, but now Christians are a majority if these numbers are right.
Yeah. Second, and remember, we're a secular organization. We say people should get entry on the basis of need, not on the basis of religion. It's an absolutely fundamental part of that.
How is need distributed by religion today? Is it easy to say?
It's hard to say. I think that if I had to guess, I would say now the number of refugees, you're talking about 45 to 50% Muslim. The number of internally displaced, which is a rather different number, there's 40 million internally displaced, 25 million refugees, it would be a slightly lower number. So, but number one, the number of Christians being allowed in is down. Number two, which is the religious group that has lost the most lives as a result of jihadist terrorism? Muslims. More Muslims have been killed by jihadists than Christians or Jews. Third point, it's a terrible mistake of foreign policy to blame a population for their own government or their own rebel or the rebel group that's incubated in their own country. Are we saying that all Afghans are responsible for the development of Al-Qaeda in that country? That would be a heartless thing to say, but it would also be a stupid thing to say, because what we actually need is Afghans who suffer the most to be mobilized against the incubation of terrorist groups in their own country. I've just come back from Yemen, a war that's been fought for the last 3.5 years after a coup against the government. The Saudi-led coalition, which the American government and the UK are supporting, has run 18,000 bombing raids in that country. 83% of the population are now living in extreme poverty. 7,500 civilians have been killed. There's a separate argument about how to get out of that, but listen to this. Which are the groups that are benefiting? Who's winning the war in Yemen? Not the Saudi-led coalition, not the Houthis they're opposing. The people who are winning are precisely the terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, who we're most afraid of, who are going to find a new bridgehead in Yemen. And so I think it's really important not to fall for this argument that somehow we're fighting the fight against ISIS by stopping refugees coming here. If you listen to someone like Mike Hayden, the former head of the CIA in the Bush administration, he'll explain to you actually this is hindering the attempt to fight ISIS because it's harder to get into trusted intelligence sources if Muslims feel that their own religion is being damned by an American government policy.
On Yemen, I'm also seeing, or I saw at least one article, in which the disappearance of that Saudi journalist, Khashoggi, and Washington Post columnist, which he also was, who is now feared dead, that mentioned in the same breath as Yemen. Is there a reason for that?
Well, it would be mentioned in the same breath because Saudi Arabia is alleged to have killed the journalist, and Saudi Arabia is the leading actor in the Yemen fight, in the war in Yemen. It's important to say that the Saudis rightly say that the Houthis shouldn't send missiles into Saudi Arabia. That's true. But equally, it's wrong for the Saudis to have bombed a coach of schoolchildren that killed 54 people in August in northern Yemen, and 7,500 civilian casualties, the vast bulk have been from the Saudi-led coalition, by the way, with American arms supplies. So that's why they're being mentioned in the same breath. What you have is a roiling Middle East at the moment. We know about the Syria crisis, 7 million refugees, 7 million internally displaced and 5 million refugees. We know about Yemen. We also know that we're still living with the reverberations of the Arab Spring of 2011-12. And I fear that this crisis in Yemen is going to become an enormous source of regional destabilization because it pits Saudi Arabia on one side, trying to regain power for their own supporters, against the Iranians, who have come in to back the Houthi side. So you've got all of the ingredients of a very, very dangerous regional situation.
And to back up on that even one more step, and maybe even put on your former UK foreign minister hat, what are the implications if the Saudi government ordered Khashoggi killed? And do you lay it at the feet of Trump at all for ceasing to have the United States comment on human rights among countries he sees as friendly, which would definitely include Saudi Arabia at this moment, especially the closeness of the king with Jared Kushner?
Well, this journalist, it's important to understand, is an American resident. So it's not just that he's written for American papers, he's got newspapers, he's got the Washington Post, he's got he's got residency status. And when I said earlier in the conversation that it was important to remember that the refugee crisis is about people who suffer persecution, not just victims of wars in large numbers, it's very important to recognize that this Khashoggi case may be a very good example of that. Now, the great danger when a country like the US says it's giving carte blanche to countries around the world to do whatever they want inside their own borders, that is not a recipe for international order. That is a recipe for international anarchy. And I just want to link, if you don't mind, I know someone wants to come in and speak, but just give me a Please. Second to say this. We're living in a world where there's an alleged murder of a Saudi dissident in a consulate in Turkey. In my own home country, the Russians have tried to kill a British citizen, a former officer. We've got the Russians hacking into the chemical weapons convention headquarters in Geneva. We've got a situation where the danger of international anarchy is real. And it's vital that countries like the US, that are meant to be anchors of the global order, recognize that the peace and prosperity we had after 1945 was built on states' rights, but it was also built on human rights. That was what changed after 1945. In contrast, the preceding hundreds of years of human history, the international order had two foundation stones in the UN Charter. And if we're not careful, we're going to lose that.
We have the former Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, standing by, who's going to have another point of view on a lot of immigration-related stuff, migration-related stuff, I believe. But last thought from you, because the UK, as you well know, is struggling right now to finalize terms of its Brexit from the European Union.
That's our national trauma.
And it's still very contentious regarding whether other Europeans will have anything more than the same travel and immigration rights as people from anywhere else in the world that's not in Europe. But I read that Brexit would affect their immigration, regular immigration, but not the UK's refugee policy. And so relevant to your work, I'm just curious if that's the case and how they do refugees compared to us in the UK?
Well, in short, that's true, because your refugee policy is a function of the signature of the International Convention on Refugees. Your immigration policy can change. It has a very different legal status. Obviously, the UK voted to leave the European Union. The government have been promising for 2 years to figure out a negotiating position. But if any of you have tried to unscramble eggs, you will have an indication of what it's like to try and withdraw from Britain to withdraw from the European Union, because we have 45 years, in fact, of detailed social, economic, environmental integration with the rest of the European Union. And the struggle at the moment is how to do that.
Are they having the same refugees and potential terrorism debate in the UK that we're having here?
No, the government, I'm afraid, is following a similar policy to the Trump administration, in that it's reducing the number of refugees who are being allowed in, including child refugees, which is particularly appalling. But interestingly enough, it's not really done. It's not really argued on the security grounds. That is much less part of the debate.
Please thank the President and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And Stephen Harper next. Stay with us.